The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power by Robert A. Caro, Part 2, Continued. Money could help with the district's political leaders, too. First it bought him Claude Wilde. The leaders knew the canny old Paul, knew him, liked him, had worked with him for years. Wilde's first reaction to the governor's suggestion that he manage Lyndon Johnson's campaign was, "Who the hell is Lyndon Johnson?" After sounding out the leaders, he was convinced not only that Johnson had absolutely no chance to win, but that his campaign would be little more than a joke, and that association with it would be an embarrassment. He at first rejected Allred's suggestion that he help the young man, and when, at the governor's insistence, he finally sat down with Johnson and Wirtz, he was unmoved by their attempt to tempt him with the title of campaign manager. He would work for the campaign, he said, only for a fee, payable in advance, $5,000. Although Lady Bird did not know it, that was where half of her father's contribution went. Wilde's enlistment in the campaign could not make the leaders support Johnson, but it would ensure their attendance at, and their permission to hold, the barbecues, political rallies highlighted by speakings, integral to Texas politics. And Lyndon Johnson's barbecues were barbecues such as this impoverished district had never seen. Ed Clark describes them as all the barbecue you could eat and take home and all the beer you could drink at each barbecue. In other words, beef and beer for hundreds of persons. Emmett Shelton describes them in a more pithy term, a giving away. Before then, he says, barbecues had never been very elaborate around here. And I tell you, we wanted to have one like his, Johnson's once, and we sat down and started figuring out how much it would cost, and there was no way we were ever going to afford it. If the barbecues with their drinking and the speaking were the loud side of money in rural Texas politics, there were quiet sides as well. The rural boxes or precincts, which could be bought by a payment to a local sheriff or county commissioner. There were a few of these boxes in the 10th District, and Johnson had the money to buy them. The district contained a substantial Negro vote, located in several small all-Negro settlements in Blanco County, in Lee County, where there were thousands of black sharecroppers, and in the Austin slums. Negroes could not vote in party primaries in Texas, but this was not a primary, but a federal election. In Austin and Lee County, at least, the Negro community voted the way its leaders wanted it to vote, and the leaders were for sale. Cheap. Johnson had the money to buy them. The check vote, several thousand checks were grouped together in three or four rural communities, was also for sale. The price for this vote was much higher, but Johnson had enough money to pay it, too. No one knows or will ever know how much money was spent in Lyndon Johnson's first campaign. Mrs. Johnson says, with understandable pride, that her money was virtually all that was needed to launch her husband's career. The deposit slip for the $10,000 she obtained from her father was one of her most cherished possessions. "I kept that deposit slip in my purse until it wore out," she says. "Literally until it just crumpled away." And she says, while Alvin Wirtz raised some money, probably the $10,000 covered the entire cost of the first campaign. But while Mrs. Johnson no doubt believes this statement, it is not correct. The Sheltons, not only Polk but his brother and campaign manager Emmett, went broke trying to keep up with Johnson's spending. Emmett vividly recalls raising at the beginning of the campaign $1,000 from one friend and $1,500 from another, and thinking it was so much, and then realizing that it was nothing. "We would not have started had we known how much the campaign was going to cost," Shelton says, "because we didn't have it. By the end of the campaign, we had borrowed everything we could borrow. It took us years to get out of the financial hole we dug for ourselves." Their expenditures totaled $40,000. Avery and Brownlee, observers agree, each spent considerably more than that figure. Johnson's expenditures dwarfed those of any of his opponents. Ed Clark, the homespun political genius who in later years would become perhaps Texas's greatest campaign fundraiser, was exercising his talents on Johnson's behalf. The governor's trusted advisor telephoned state employees. "If I said to someone, 'The governor would like you to support his friend Lyndon Johnson,' they knew I was authorized to make the call. Their contributions were small, $20 or $10 or even less," Clark says, "but there were a considerable number of them. More money came to Johnson from Austin businessmen, suppliers of Camp Mabry, a United States Army base, for example, who, in Clark's words, thought it would help them to be friends with a congressman. These contributions were not so small. These would be $100 to $500, Clark says. And there were a considerable number of these, too. And his money came from men who were used to contributing far larger sums to politics, not only from Alvin Wirtz, but Roy Miller, for example, and from lobbyists who contributed where Wirtz and Miller told them to contribute. Although pro forma reports on campaign spending were filed, Johnson's shows contributions of $2,242.74, they are not reliable, Clark says. Only three men, Lyndon Johnson, Alvin Wirtz, and Ed Clark, had even a vague idea of the total amount spent. Johnson and Wirtz are dead. Clark says that he does not know the actual figure. There wasn't too much reporting then, he says. No one knew how much money was spent. But he estimates the cost of Lyndon Johnson's first campaign at between $75,000 and $100,000, a figure that would make the campaign one of the most expensive congressional races in Texas history up to that time. And most of all, Johnson had the qualities of personality and temperament that he had been displaying most of his life. All his adult life, because of the agonies of his youth, the insecurity and shame of growing up in the hill country as the son of Sam and Rebecca Johnson, he had grasped frantically at every chance, no matter how slender, to escape that past. In Washington, and before that in Houston and Cotulla, he had worked so feverishly, driven himself so furiously, forced his young will to be flexible, had whipped himself into the frantic, furious effort that journalists and biographers would call energy when it was really desperation and fear. He had tried to do everything, everything possible to succeed, to earn respect, to be somebody. There was a feeling if you did everything, you would win. The feeling had been reinforced, in Washington and Houston and Cotulla, by experience. In each of those jobs, he had done everything, had lashed himself into the effort in which hours made no difference, days made no difference, nights made no difference, into the effort in which he worked weekday and weekend, day and night, and he had won, had made the most of each of those slender chances. Now had come the main chance, the real chance, quite possibly the only chance. And the effort that Lyndon Johnson had made before was nothing beside the effort he made now. He could not, he felt, win in the city. Austin, home of 88,000 of the district's 264,000 residents, was controlled by Mayor Miller, and Miller was for Avery. So he had to win in the countryside. But that countryside covered almost 8,000 square miles. The 10th Congressional District of Texas was one of the most sparsely populated areas of the United States. Its 176,000 residents who lived outside Austin were scattered across 10 huge Texas counties, across an area larger than Delaware, larger than Connecticut, larger than Delaware and Connecticut combined. Austin, of course, was situated at the very edge of the Edwards Plateau, near the fateful 98th Meridian. To the west of Austin, the district, 3,000 square miles of district, was the vast and empty hill country, through which it was still possible in 1937 to drive for miles without seeing a human habitation. The 62-mile drive west from Austin through Johnson City to the district's border, for example, was still one of the loneliest trips it was possible to make in the United States. The 111-mile trip from Austin to the district's eastern border lay across prairies whose black soil was more fertile than the hill country's limestone, but whose population was almost as sparse. And in political terms, the terms that mattered to Lyndon Johnson, it was not the sparseness of the district's population that was most intimidating, but the pattern in which it was distributed. With the exception of Austin, the district contained not a single large community. Only six towns, Brenham, San Marcos, Lockhart, Luling, Taylor, and Georgetown, had even 3,000 inhabitants. Many of the district's country people lived in towns too small to be marked on any map. Most of the district's country people didn't live in any town, or near any town. The voters Lyndon Johnson would have to convince to vote for him voters, most of whom had never even heard the name of Lyndon Johnson, were scattered on their isolated farms and ranches so thinly across those immense spaces that a candidate could drive miles between one voter and the next. Difficult miles. Two major highways ran through the district, east-west, U.S. Highway 290, and north-south, U.S. Highway 81. Most of the district's other roads were unpaved. In 1937, the 58 miles of State Highway 66, between Johnson City and the northern boundary of Burnett County, for example, were largely unpaved. And most of the district's voters did not live on 290 or 81, or even on 66. Their homes, the farms and ranches on which lay the votes which alone could enable him to take advantage of his great chance, lay on 1,000 separate, long, winding, rutted roads that were little more than paths or cow trails. These roads were, moreover, the only way to reach these voters. Newspapers could reach them with only limited impact. Almost none of them received a newspaper more than once a week. The circulation of the daily newspapers read in the district, the Austin American and Statesman, combined circulation 30,000, the San Antonio Light, the Dallas News, was limited almost entirely to Austin. Many of them received no newspaper at all, either because their homes were too isolated to make delivery even of a weekly feasible, or because they simply could not afford a subscription. Radio could reach them hardly at all. By now an established political tool in other areas of the United States, it was a tool with limited use indeed in rural precincts, few of whose residents owned one. The first survey of the use of electrical appliances in rural areas of the 10th District, conducted in 1939, would disclose the presence of a radio in exactly one out of every 119 homes. Out of reach of the media, these voters were, most of them at least, out of reach also of personal influence. Here and there a local influential, a lead man in Central Texas parlance, wielded influence beyond his immediate family, either because of the local power he might exercise, if he was the town banker, or the town lawyer, or the county judge, or simply because people so isolated from news media relied for their political opinions, to an extent unthinkable in a city, on men whose opinions they respected. A successful farmer, for example. Here and there was a crooked box or election precinct whose votes could be purchased wholesale by a payment to an election judge or local sheriff. But in this district, lead men and crooked boxes were few. There was no way to persuade these voters en masse to support a candidate of whom most of them had never heard. The only way to obtain the votes Lyndon Johnson needed was the hardest way, one by one. He started early. The announcement of his candidacy had appeared on Monday, and he was on the road before daylight on Tuesday, March 2nd, with 40 days to go before Election Day, as his chauffeur, Carol Keach, headed out along 290 on the 111-mile trip to Washington-on-the-Brazos, a score of ramshackle frame buildings huddled on a bluff above the muddy yellow river that marked the district's eastern border. The Texas Declaration of Independence had been signed in the little town on March 2, 1836. Johnson's hero ancestor, John Wheeler Bunton, had been one of the signers. Every March 2nd, farmers and ranchers flocked there to celebrate, and Johnson wanted to be there to greet them. And when he left the town, he didn't head straight back to Austin. After 15 miles to the southwest was a junction with a dirt road, muddy, rutted, almost impassable because of deep puddles left by recent rains. But 9 miles down that road was the town of Independence. Johnson had heard that morning that some of its 319 residents, deterred by the road conditions, had not attended the celebration. So he ordered Keach to turn off on the dirt road and drive to Independence, so that he could greet them too. His opponents, accustomed to the leisurely pace normal in Texas elections, had not expected the campaign to start until Allred set a date for the election. On the day, March 5th, that the governor set the date as April 10th, Johnson had already completed a tour of the entire district and was holding his rally in Old Main. Not having begun preparations until after the governor's announcement, the other candidates were some time completing them. When Avery opened his campaign on March 9th, Johnson had already been in the field for a week. Merton Harris promised a very active campaign in the opening statement he issued on March 11th, but he actually did not begin until March 18th, only a little more than 3 weeks before the election. Senator Brownlee said that he would not campaign until after the Senate adjourned, so that he could attend to his duties. And adjournment did not come until March 27th. Johnson didn't need an alarm clock. During their 38 years of married life, Lady Bird says, "I don't ever remember Lyndon, when something important was afoot, ever oversleeping." What woke Lyndon Johnson was more insistent than any bell. And since he had given Carol Keach a room over his garage, the big brown Pontiac would be already idling at the curb when, at daybreak or before, Johnson walked out to it. First, Keach would drive him downtown to his campaign headquarters, a big room on the mezzanine of the Stephen F. Austin Hotel, where he would be handed his itinerary for the day, a list of the influential men he would meet. Keach would head out of the city while Johnson sat reading beside him on the front seat. The reading could not have been encouraging. Lyndon Johnson had spent 4 years learning a district, the hardest type of district to learn, a rural district in which there was little formal political organization with identifiable officials. In a rural district, a newcomer could ascertain the identity of a town's true leaders, which storekeeper was respected, which farmer was listened to by other farmers, only through endless hours of subtle probing of reticent men. He had spent 4 years learning not only which men to talk to, but what to say to them, who was proud of a daughter and who was ashamed, who was really for Roosevelt and who only said he was. And he had learned a district well. But that had been another district. The knowledge he had worked so hard to acquire was useless to him here, in rural precincts he had never even visited. Sometimes no one in Johnson's campaign headquarters even knew how to reach the tiny communities to which he was traveling that day. The itinerary he was handed would contain directions that were sketchy, incorrect, or simply non-existent. During the early days of the campaign, until he himself had written out directions, typical notation made by this future President of the United States, Grassyville, 5 miles below Page, back over same road, to Schwertner, back to Gerald, Gerald to Theon, second left out of town, then to Wahlberg, Wahlberg to Weir, Weir to Jonah, Jonah to Georgetown. He had to stop constantly and ask directions, and even so, often spent a precious hour jolting over a cow path into the hills, only to find it was the wrong cow path. A lost candidate in a lost cause, wandering around a huge district he didn't know. Often, his aides didn't even know the correct name of the community's lead man. The memorandum he was handed on the Wahlberg precinct informed him that it's about 110 votes all go one way, at the direction of G.W. Cassens. Or was it C.W.? Unfamiliar even with the names of the lead men, his aides were of course unfamiliar with the men themselves. He had to win them over unarmed, without even a clue as to their politics or their prejudices. A typical daily memo told him that at his first stop, Lytton Springs, he should see Mr. Frank Gamillion, who may or may not be for you. Three key farmers in the next area, Dale, were listed. Not only was he given no hint of where in the Dale area's 200 square miles their farms might be found, he was given no hint of their views. Who these men stand for is unknown, the memo said. Traveling to these isolated communities was no more discouraging than the reception he received when he arrived. Johnson had spent 4 years not only learning a district, but helping a district, working with boundless energy and ingenuity to solve its people's problems. He had earned a district's gratitude. But that had been another district. This new district had no idea of what he had done. What must Lyndon Johnson have thought after 4 years of tirelessly obtaining pensions for hundreds of veterans, when, heading out to Red Rock one morning, he read a memorandum advising him that it was necessary for him to get on record concerning veterans' pensions? The district's ignorance about his accomplishments magnified the misgivings aroused by his age. Claude Wilde had dispatched a veteran Texas politician, Hick Halcombe, to reconnoiter some towns before Johnson visited them to ascertain their initial reaction to his candidacy, and Halcombe's confidential memos to Wilde contained, over and over again, an ominous phrase, "too young." Addressing himself to the voters he met in these towns, the quiet, closed-faced farmers, Johnson could see that Halcombe's pessimism was well-founded. Sam Johnson had a favorite saying, "You can't be in politics unless you can walk in a room and know in a minute who's for you and who's against you." Sam's son possessed the gift to which his father had referred. He could see who was for him, and he saw that very few were for him. The formal speeches he gave in these towns did not do much to improve the situation. These speeches were generally delivered on Saturday. Traditionally, rural campaigning in Texas was largely restricted to Saturdays, the day on which farmers and their wives came into town to shop, and could be addressed in groups. On Saturdays, two automobiles, Johnson's brown Pontiac and Bill Deason's wired-for-sound gray Chevy, would head out of Austin for a swing through several large towns. On the outskirts of each town, Johnson would get out of the Pontiac. He thought it looked a little too elaborate for a man running for Congress, Keach says, and walk into the town, while the Chevy would pull into the square, and Deason or some other aide would use the loudspeaker to urge voters to "come see Lyndon Johnson, your next congressman," and to "come hear Lyndon Johnson speak at the square." To drum up enthusiasm, records would be played over the loudspeaker. "The Washington Post march, I can still hear it ringing now," Keach recalls. But the crowds who came to hear this unknown campaigner were very small, their size discouraging when compared to those who had come to hear Avery or Harris or Brownlee, and the speeches did not move them to much enthusiasm for his candidacy. Written by Alvin Wirtz and Herbert Henderson, their single theme, all-out support of Franklin D. Roosevelt and the New Deal, was the right one for that district, and that year when the Supreme Court fight was constantly on the front page of the Austin newspapers. But Johnson's delivery of his theme lessened its effectiveness. When he read from a prepared text, and if he had one before him he could not seem to stop reading it, his phrasing was as awkward and stilted as his gestures. He shouted the speech without inflection. Although he was continually urged by his advisers to look at his audience, he did so infrequently, as if he were afraid to lose his place in the text. After the formal speech, however, Johnson would circulate through the town, shaking hands with its people, and suddenly there was no awkwardness at all. When he saw someone he knew, his lean white face would, in the words of a hill country resident, just light up. He would stride over, ungainly in his eagerness, and call the man's name. "Old Herman," he would say, "how you coming?" He would put his arm around Herman's shoulders. "How are you?" he would say. "I'm awful glad to see you." Looking up at that face, alight with happiness, even the crustiest, most reserved farmer might be warmed by its glow. And the glow would deepen with fond recollection. "Well, the last time I saw you was at the horse races up to Fredericksburg," Johnson would say. "We had a good time, didn't we? Remember that mare we bet on?" Lyndon Johnson had not seen some of the people he was greeting for 10 years, but his memory of good times they had shared seemed as vivid as if the times had been yesterday. And so was his memory of the names of their kinfolk. Recalls his cousin Ava, he would say, "It's been a long time, how so-and-so?" And he'd always know some member of his family to talk about. Listening to him, I realized he had a mind that didn't forget anything. "Well, how's your boy coming? I remember him." His questions got the other man talking. In no more than an instant, it seemed, a rapport would be established. The rapport would be cemented with physical demonstrations of affection. With women, the cement was a hug and a kiss on the cheek. The technique was as effective for him as a candidate as it had been for him as a teenager. Lyndon's kissing became almost a joke during the campaign, but a fond joke. One elderly hill country rancher, annoyed by his wife's insistence on attending a Johnson rally, growled, "Oh, you just want to be kissed." The rancher agreed to take her, but she was ill on the day of the rally, and he went alone. Upon his return, he told his wife in some wonder, "He kissed me." With men, the rapport was cemented with a handshake, and a handshake as delivered by Lyndon Johnson could be as effective as a hug. All politicians shake hands, of course, but they didn't shake hands as Lyndon Johnson did. "Listen," Lyndon Johnson would say, standing, lean and earnest and passionate, before a hill country rancher he remembered from his youth. "Listen, I'm running for Congress. I want your support. I want your vote. And if you know anybody who can help me, I want you to get them to help me. I need help. Will you help me? Will you give me your helping hand? Will you give me your helping hand? It was only as he asked that last question that Lyndon Johnson raised his own hand, extending it in entreaty. With voters he didn't know, his approach was equally distinctive. He wanted their hands, too, in his, and after a brief, "I'm Lyndon Johnson, and I'm running for Congress, and I hope that you will lend me your helping hand," he would reach out and grasp them. Then, with his hand entwined with the voters, he would ask questions. "What's your name? Where are you from? What's your occupation?" And then, as Ava says, there was that memory again. That was the key. He always knew somebody. "I know your mother or your father or some friend. I've met so-and-so. He told me about you." He made a connection. 7 years before, still a 21-year-old undergraduate, Lyndon Johnson had campaigned for Welly Hopkins. That campaign had been Johnson's first. But Hopkins, watching the tall, gangling college boy, had concluded that he had a gift, a very unusual ability to meet and greet the public. Now others saw that gift. They watched Lyndon Johnson's hand reach out to a voter, and they saw the voter's hand reach out in return. They saw that once a voter's hand was grasped in his, the voter wanted to leave it there. They saw that after he had talked to a voter for a minute or two, his arm around him, smiling down into his eyes, the voter did not want the talk to end. What people saw was friendliness and sincerity, a love of people, Ray Lee says. The instant empathy Johnson created began, in fact, to cause problems for campaign aides trying to keep him on a tight Saturday schedule. An aide would attempt to urge Johnson along, but the voter, still holding tight to his hand, would walk along with him, trying to prolong the conversation. Sometimes several voters would walk along. Waiting in the Pontiac, Keach would see Johnson coming, and there would be a small crowd behind him, a crowd reluctant to see him go. Sometimes, says Lee, it was a problem to get him out of town. And he didn't campaign only on Saturdays. On the other days of the week, the other candidates campaigned mainly in Austin, or in a big town such as Brenham or Lockhart, or, quite often, did not campaign at all. On those days, Johnson campaigned in the tiny towns that dotted the district. No speech had been scheduled for those towns, and none had been prepared by his speechwriters. But more and more often now, he had to give one. A voter who had shaken his hand would begin following him, and another would join him, and another, and soon a 10th district version of a crowd, 15 men and women perhaps, or 20 or 25, 25 would be quite a crowd, Deason says, would gather, and someone would shout, "Let's hear a speech," and someone else would shout, "Come on, Lyndon, let's have a speaking," and he would be pushed up onto the bed of a truck or a wagon. And if Lyndon Johnson with a speech in his hands was stilted and stiff and unconvincing, Lyndon Johnson without a speech, Lyndon Johnson alone and unprotected on a flatbed truck, no paper prepared by others to hide behind, nothing to look at but the faces of strangers, Lyndon Johnson with nothing to rely on but himself, was, nervous though he was, his cousin Ava, who had known him since he was a child, saw that he was terrified up there, gangling and big-eared and awkward though he was, suddenly was also a candidate with gifts, very unusual gifts, that went far beyond meeting and greeting. When, on such unplanned occasions, he talked about the president, it wasn't in Herb Henderson's phrases or Alvin Wirtz's phrases, but in his own. "Don't you remember what cotton was selling at when Mr. Roosevelt went into office?" he would ask. "Don't you remember when it was selling at a nickel? Don't you remember when it was cheaper to shoot your cattle than to feed them? Don't you remember when you couldn't get a loan and the banks were going to take your land away? I'm a farmer like you. I was raised up on a farm. I know what it's like to be afraid that they're going to take your land away. And that's why I'm for Mr. Roosevelt." "What president ever cared about the farmer before Mr. Roosevelt?" he would ask. "Did Hoover care about the farmer? Did Coolidge care about the farmer? The only president who ever cared about the farmer was Franklin D. Roosevelt. He was for the poor man. He wanted to give the poor man a chance. He wanted the farmers to have a break. And he gave them a break. He gave us a break. He's the one who did it for us. He's the one who's doing it for us. And he's the one who's going to do it for us. And I'm backing him." The people before him were, many of them, people he had seen for the first time only a few minutes before. But as a result of his brief conversations with them, he could attach to their faces not only names, but circumstances of their lives, and in so doing could make them feel that their destiny was linked to Roosevelt's destiny and to Lyndon Johnson's. "John Miller," he would say, "didn't you just now tell me you was going under when the soil conservation came in, and they started paying you to let your land lie out? Well, whose program is it that's paying the farmers to let their land lie out? Roosevelt's program. Take the CCC. Now, it's helping you, Herman. Didn't you tell me your boy's over to Carville doing terracing? Well, whose program do you think CCC is? Roosevelt's. All these programs that have got the farmer out of the hole are Roosevelt's programs. He's the man who's doing it for you, and I'm behind him. It'll take somebody in Congress to keep pushing for the things he wants, and you need to send a congressman up there who knows this." Their destinies were linked because of the Supreme Court fight, he told the farmer standing before him. The court had already struck down one program that had helped the farmer, the AAA. Whose fault was it that the government cotton certificates they were holding could no longer be redeemed? Who knew what programs the Supreme Court would strike down next? Can you afford to risk the loss of your personal progress under Mr. Roosevelt? I tell you, this fight of the president is one that affects you and me right in this district. It means our bread and butter, and our children's bread and butter. That was why, he said, they should vote for Lyndon Johnson. The eyes of the nation are on us right here, he would say. The whole country's watching what you do on April 10th. This is the first and only test at the polls in all of the United States of the president's program. The other candidates in the congressional race were all alike, he said. Sure, only two of them were openly opposing the court plan, but the rest, he said, are noncommittal, vacillating, temporizing. They're hanging back like a steer on the way to the dipping vat. Only one man in this race has taken a positive stance, he said. I am that man. A vote for me will show the president's enemies that the people are behind him. This is the test. Mr. Roosevelt is in trouble now. When we needed help, he helped us. Now he needs help. Are we going to give it to him? Are you going to give it to him? Are you going to help Mr. Roosevelt? That's what this election is all about. Don't let anybody kid you. That's what this election is all about. No fundamentalist preacher, thundering of fire and brimstone in one of the famed Hill Country revival meetings, had called the people of the Hill Country to the banner of Jesus Christ more fervently than Lyndon Johnson called them to the banner of Franklin Roosevelt. And as in revival meetings, passions rose. Often they began to spill over when Johnson began talking about the NYA. That was when Lyndon really touched people, says his cousin Ava, because what people here wanted more than anything else was for their children to have a better life than they had had. Seeing a young man in the crowd, Johnson would speak directly to him, but in words that touched chords in the parents in the crowd. Calling the young man by name, he would tell him that he knew what it took to get an education if you were a poor boy. He knew, he said, because he had been a poor boy, and he had gotten an education. There's an education for every boy and girl that wants one, he would say. It's up to you. You can get it if you want it. You have to work for it. You can do what I did. You can pick up paper. You can pick up rocks. You can wash dishes. You can fill up cars. You can do a lot of things if you want that education. But if you want it, you can get it. A Roosevelt program, the NYA, would help you get it, he said. And if he, Lyndon Johnson, was elected congressman, he would help you get it. He had already helped others. Turning to a father in the audience, he would demand, "Well, how's your boy coming? I remember him. Didn't I get him a job down in San Marcos? How's he coming?" Suddenly his voice would not be the only voice. "Oh, yes, you sure did," the father would shout back. "You got him that job, and he's doing just fine. We're sure proud of him." Another voice would shout, "That's right, Lyndon. You tell him, Lyndon." Another voice would shout, "Amen." And all at once many voices would be shouting, "Amen, Lyndon. Amen, Lyndon. You tell him, Lyndon." And sometimes the response took a form even more impressive than shouting. Sometimes, Carol Keach says, when the chief would start talking, the people in the crowd would be kidding with him and laughing. But then he'd really get started, and the crowd would get quieter and quieter. Finally, there would just be a group of farmers standing there and listening very hard, without saying one word. Observers, less impressionable than Keach, started noticing the same phenomenon. On March 16th, Johnson was pushed up onto a flatbed truck in Lockhart for an impromptu talk. Hick Halcombe, the old Paul who was following Johnson around for Claude Wilde, was present. His memo to Wilde that night did not have its customary cynical flavor. Speech was to some 45 men who listened unusually attentively, it said. 2 days later, Halcombe reported from Georgetown. Johnson made a speech at urgence of group on street corner. Spoke to 64 people. Not a man moved out of his tracks during speech. Another report was filed from Bastrop. Reaction to Johnson's appearance started folks talking, Halcombe wrote. I followed him and listened to such remarks as these. He's a fine-looking chap. He's a go-getter. Halcombe's memos began to have a different tone. It was hard to believe, he told Wilde, but he was beginning to think that maybe Lyndon Johnson had a chance. If men, even men who had long known Lyndon Johnson, now became aware of new dimensions of his gift, his ability not only to meet but move the public, they became aware also of new dimensions of the effort he would make in using that gift. And the men who knew Lyndon Johnson best, who knew best how utterly unsparing of himself he was willing to be, how hours made no difference, days made no difference, nights made no difference, had felt at the start of the campaign that, as Gene Latimer put it, no matter what anyone said, we felt he had a chance because we knew he would work harder than anyone else. But even these men had not known how hard he would work. Very few of the local influentials, the lead men, were for him. The leaders in the four counties in which Harris had been district attorney knew Harris. The leaders in the counties Brownlee represented in the legislature knew Brownlee. The leaders in Williamson County knew Sam Stone. Leaders throughout the entire district, because they had needed favors from Buchanan, knew Buchanan's man Avery. When Johnson visited them, they were courteous to him, but they also let him know quite clearly that their allegiances, forged over many years, were not transferable to a stranger, particularly not to some young, too young stranger, who thought he should be a congressman. But he didn't stop visiting them. In Brenham, for example, he was, as Keach puts it, working on an old judge, Sam D.W. Lowe. His house sat on a knoll, and the judge sat on the porch. After calling on Lowe, Johnson would come back to the car and say, "Boy, I don't know, that was a tough cookie. Well, I tried, anyway." He kept trying. Lowe told Johnson he was for Avery and was going to stay for Avery. But, Keach says, he, Johnson, kept going back. Many times I sat on the road in the car watching him take the long walk up that trail to the house where the judge was sitting on the porch. He kept going back, even to the one leader who did not, in dealing with Johnson, observe the tradition of courtesy. Austin's beefy mayor Miller, an arrogant, hot-tempered man who had taken an instant and deep dislike to Johnson. Johnson humbled himself before him. Returning to Austin after a day's campaigning, he would sometimes tell Keach to drive by the mayor's big house on Niles Road. If Miller's car was parked there, indicating that the mayor was home, he would ring the doorbell and ask if he could come inside for a talk. Miller never wavered in his views, but Johnson never stopped dropping by. One lead man who was for him, because his daughter was married to Johnson aide Ray Lee, was County Judge Will Burnett of Hayes County. But Hayes looked bad for Johnson nonetheless. The county was the site of San Marcos, and of Johnson's alma mater, Southwest Texas State Teachers College. As the Austin American put it, Johnson was prime mover in organization of a college secret society known as the White Stars, which for some years controlled campus politics. The college days' animosities have carried over into later political life. Johnson needed Judge Will not just to support him, but to actively campaign for him. The road to the Burnett Ranch, where the Stone Ranch House was occupied by the judge's father, the judge lived in a log cabin dog run, was paved. A county judge's road was always paved. But it was so isolated, deep in the hill country fastnesses, that from the nearest town, San Marcos, it was 24 miles to the ranch. Yet every time Johnson finished campaigning in San Marcos, no matter how late the hour, he would tell Keach not to head back for Austin, but to head instead into the blackness of a hill country night to see Judge Will. He kept going back to towns, too, visiting repeatedly not just the district's six big towns in which the other candidates campaigned, but tiny villages which most of the other candidates never visited at all. Many of these towns did not even have a town square. They consisted of a line of little stores along the road. On a typical day, he would stop in five or six towns, going into each business establishment on the square or along the road, shaking hands, talking for a few minutes wherever he found a group, speaking while leaning on counters. Made favorable impression on farmers in Bayer's store by eating lunch on counter, cheese, crackers, soda pop, Halcombe reported. And on bars. The fact that Lyndon talked to old man Pfluger in beer joint and treated nine to beers didn't hurt any. Speaking through swirling lint, in cotton gins whose owners had been persuaded to stop the pounding of the baler long enough so the workers could hear him speak, and in front of blazing forges. L.J. talked informally to a group of about eight in a blacksmith shop. Of this group, John Coward Farmer was thoroughly sold. Henry Conley, Raymond Welsh, Albert Gardner, all veterans, were given sales talk, but they are still uncommittal. L.J. recited his record in getting claims through. If Johnson was to win this election, however, it would not be in towns that he won it. The votes that he needed could not be harvested in groups even as large as nine or eight. So during the 40 days, the 40 long days of his first campaign, towns were only stopping places. His real campaign was waged outside the towns, and the vast empty spaces of the hills and the plains. Scattered outside the towns along the lonely roads, sometimes paved, usually graveled, were occasional general stores. He stopped at every store, purchasing some small item in each so as to predispose the proprietor toward him. If not cheese and crackers, then a can of sardines, which he would open and eat on the counter. If he was lucky, there would be a farmer or two there, and he could talk to several people at once. If no one was inside but the storekeeper, he would talk to the storekeeper, in as casual and unhurried a manner as if he had nothing else in the world to do. Scattered along the roads were filling stations, and he stopped at every one of these, too. At most of these stations there was only one pump outside and one voter, the proprietor, inside. But he chatted unhurriedly with that voter. To ensure that he would be able to buy some gas at each station, he was careful never to fill his tank completely. Polk Shelton's brother Emmett recalls the lesson in country campaigning that Johnson gave him. "I drove down to Smithville one day. I'd been planning to put posters in gas station windows. But every time I would get to one, Lyndon had been there before us, and at each one he would go in and buy a gallon or two. We didn't need any gas. I'd filled up before we left, so they were a little cold to us." Between the stores and the filling stations, along the lonely roads, other roads, unpaved, ungraveled, often ungraded, would cut off. These roads led into the hills or across endless expanses of prairie on which no house or human figure could be seen. He turned off on those roads. The Pontiac might bounce along them for miles. Cutting off from them would be other, even narrower roads, mere paths leading up into the hills, no more, which led to individual farms. He turned off on every path. Sometimes, so scattered were homesteads in this district, in which 40 acres were needed to support a single cow, he had to travel for miles along such a path. At intervals, a gate would bar it to keep the cattle from straying. Johnson would get out and swing it open, careful to close it after Keach drove through. The path would grow rougher. The big car would lurch along the ruts. The slow progress would continue mile after mile, before finally, sometimes far off in the distance, a farmer would be seen at work in his fields. This book is continued on cassette number 8, side 1.